on the clock. On the night that you stay awake, the shivers will hit you somewhere around 4 or 5 a.m., just about the time when you might otherwise pull up an extra blanket and sleep for another few hours. Although people often assume that the shivers come at the coldest part of the night, the actual explanation is found within the body itself. Sleep is one way of conserving energy. During the night, when we are inactive, it isn't necessary to generate as much energy as we need for our daily business of moving around, finding food, and so forth. So instead of maintaining the same temperature all day, which would waste a lot of our energy, our body temperature rises and falls in accordance to what is needed. This kind of pattern is called a circadian rhythm because it takes one day to complete before starting over. The circadian temperature rhythm continues to run regardless of whether you yourself have decided to go to sleep or not. Your body, you might say, executes the same strategy for conserving energy during what were supposed to be your off hours. Your internal temperature descends to its lowest point late at night when you would normally have been in deep sleep. This conservation mode is experienced by you as a creeping sensation that the room is getting colder and colder, when in fact, it's your own body that is generating less and less heat. Do this for several nights in a row, and your temperature rhythm will begin to adjust itself. But anytime you keep yourself awake when your body expects to be asleep, those early morning shivers will return. This moment of science comes from Indiana University. Today's program was prepared by William Oram, with help from Henry Prang in the Medical Sciences Program. For a moment of science, I'm Don Glass.
In sports at 2:41, through the first two games of the football season, Illinois has played hot and cold. The 24th-ranked Illini have piled up yards and points. They've also made mistakes and conceded big plays on the way to a 1-1 record. The Illini have one more tune-up game to get it right, Saturday at home against 0-1 Louisiana Lafayette. After Illinois plays the Ragin' Cajuns, it gets a week off before they open the Big Ten schedule at 17th-ranked Penn State. The Illini beat Eastern Illinois last weekend 47-21, but the Panthers piled up 176 yards rushing. Illini head coach Ron Zook calls his team's defensive problems correctable. Louisiana Lafayette gave up more than 400 yards rushing in its opener, but Ragin' Cajun coach Ricky Bussell thinks his team can match up physically with the Illini. Ohio State coach Jim Tressel says it's now doubtful that starting tailback Chris Beanie Wells will play in Saturday night's game against top-ranked Southern California. Tressel said today Wells is still suffering from lingering soreness in his right foot. Wells injured his foot in the Buckeyes opener. Saturday's game between McNeese State and Cal Poly in Lake Charles, Louisiana, has been canceled because of Hurricane Ike. The school took the action because of potential effects on the area. The only day game in the Major League Baseball schedule is in Minneapolis, where they're in extra innings now, and Kansas City and Minnesota are tied at 2 apiece. The Twins entered play today with a one-game deficit in the American League Central to the Chicago White Sox. The White Sox tonight will send Gavin Floyd to the mound when they try to split a 4-game series with Toronto. The Blue Jays are countering with Sean Markham. And a costly loss for the St. Louis Cardinals last night was a much-needed win for the Cubs as they open up their lead over St. Louis in the National League Central to 9 games. The Cards fell to 4th place in the division. They'll try to get back at the Cubs tonight with Todd Wellmeyer pitching against Ted Lilly. The Cubs are currently 4.5 games ahead of Milwaukee and 8.5 ahead of Houston. And that's a look at sports.
Support for today's broadcast comes from the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute at the University of Illinois, hosting a lifelong learning program developed specifically for adults over 50. Additional information on programs available at 244-9141.
It's 2:44 in the afternoon magazine. There's a new trend among biotechnology companies. Drug companies and entrepreneurs are beginning to develop and market products tailored specifically to the genetic makeup of individual patients. They look at your DNA and come up with a product that works for you. The idea is to make treatments and dosages more precise and more effective. From Seattle, NPR's Wendy Kaufman reports.
Scientist Reshma Joshi is on the front line in a new approach toward medicine and healthcare, one based on a patient's genetic makeup. Seated at a lab bench at Iverson Genetics Diagnostics, Joshi pulls on purple latex gloves and begins to transfer blood samples into test tubes in preparation for analyzing a patient's DNA.
We need to get the DNA from the nucleus. So we are breaking open the cell and getting the DNA to float out, and then we're going to spec it, and then we're going to run different analysis, different genetic analysis.
The The goal of this particular test is to determine what dose of a potent and widely prescribed anticoagulant, known as warfarin, a patient should get. Because of their genetic makeup, individuals metabolize the drug differently. And if they get too much of the drug for their body, they could bleed internally, too little, and they could suffer a stroke. Some 2 million new prescriptions of the drug are issued each year, and initially, doctors often have a hard time prescribing the ideal amount. But as Dean Sproles, founder and CEO of Iverson, explains, with DNA testing, that should become much easier.
We can read the results, report the results back to your physician, and the physician is then able to prescribe the accurate dose for warfarin.
Iverson is just one of several companies working on warfarin dosing. Genetic tests have been developed for other drugs as well, including cancer and AIDS drugs. Some medications, including warfarin, must now carry labels recommending genetic testing, and testing is required before women are given Herceptin for breast cancer. Health economist Mark Pauly of the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School says the ability to figure out if a drug will work for someone and at what dose couldn't have come at a better time.
In a way, the timing is good because the pace of discovery of new drug products has really dropped off quite substantially. So discovering something useful would actually be good news for the healthcare sector as a whole now.
But as with many breakthroughs, this one has a potentially dark side. Insurers might try to use the genetic information to increase an individual's premium or deny coverage altogether. Wharton's Pauly also worries that once the drug companies can figure out who will benefit from a drug, they might raise the price, saying in essence, we both know this drug will work for you, so you'll have to pay more. Still, genetic testing of this sort holds tremendous promise to improve healthcare. And Raju Kushalapati, who heads the Center for Genetics and Genomics at Harvard Medical School, says the roughly $2 billion DNA testing industry is poised for growth.
Within the next 10 years or so, it's expected it might go to as much as $15 billion. So in terms of the overall size of the market is not huge, but the rate of growth is expected to be very significant.
The genetic testing industry is just the tip of the iceberg, some of the earliest applications of what is being called a personalized approach to medicine. Wendy Kaufman, NPR News, Seattle.
It's 2:47 on the Afternoon Magazine, and a little bit earlier, Celeste Quinn had conducted a brief interview with the person who produced the special on Memorial Stadium, True Illini Spirit. That's John Paul. We'll take another listen to that special as the special appears again tonight at 7:30 on our companion station, WILL-TV.
We know that tune, don't we? Well, here are some names to go with it. Grange, Hallis, Grabowski, Butkus. These are four of the football greats that made their names on the field at Memorial Stadium at the University of Illinois. But Memorial Stadium's story involves more than football. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. WILL-TV senior producer John Paul says the story of the stadium is one of true Illini spirit. John Paul is the producer, together with Denise LaGrassa, of the new documentary, Memorial Stadium, True Illini Spirit. The documentary that tells the story of the 85-year-old stadium will premiere next Tuesday night, September 9th at 7 on WILL-TV. The premiere coincides with this Saturday's rededication of the renovated stadium. And John Paul is my guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. Good to see you.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Sure. So what inspired the title, True Illini Spirit?
You know, several things. As we began researching the history of the stadium dating back into the early 20s, you found that there was a spirit of the people not only that played football prior to the building of the stadium, but also those who the athletic director at the time, George Huff. And we kept looking around for something that would capture the essence of this spirit that led to the construction of the stadium. And the marching Illini, as they march out, I guess, I'm not quite sure how to put that, when they perform the 3-1 at halftime, one of the songs near the beginning of the 3-1 is called The March of the Illini. And in that, The band members sing, "We're marching for dear old Illini, for the men who are fighting for you." Well, that's exactly the spirit that led to the stadium. Near the end of those lyrics, they sing, "We are marching and singing in true Illini spirit." And that's where it came from. That's where we really pulled the title from. And it really is the essence of it.
Okay. Well, what do you say we take a listen to the marching Illini performing the lyric? Now, the stadium opened, as I have it, on November 3rd of 1923.
That was the first game played. The fall of 23, they rushed to get the stadium done for the homecoming game. Stadium wasn't done at that point.
Right.
Only the east and west stands were done. The towers were not done. The horseshoe was not done. None of the landscaping around the stadium was done. In fact, as you'll learn when you watch the documentary next Tuesday night on WILL, many of the people that went to that game literally lost their shoes and boots in the mud, but went on into the game. The next Monday, as the construction workers came back, they pulled a wagon full, because at that point it was a wagon, a wagon full of shoes and boots out of the mud for people who just left them there. They were, and they had better than 60,000 people at that first game. Of course, the game that everybody remembers was a year later in October of 1924, which was the dedication game in which Red Grange made college football famous.
Yeah, and the game was against?
The University of Michigan.
Right.
We were not expected to win. Michigan and Illinois were both undefeated the previous year in 1923. Michigan expected to literally clean our clocks and said Grange isn't going to be a factor in the game. Well, he ran the opening kickoff back 95 yards and the rest is history.
Yeah. Now, before the game, you know, there were people coming into the stadium and, you know, it hadn't been that long since the war ended. And I wonder what it was like for the people who were among the first to walk into the stadium and see these memorials.
You know, the colonnades on the east and west side are the real memorial aspect of that building. And that's the part that I think many football fans fail to appreciate. They come for the game. They come for the stands. They see those pillars outside, but they don't recognize that each one of them stands for a true fighting Illini from World War I. At least most of them do. There is a Wolverine column. You'll find out why there's a Michigan Wolverine being honored among the Illini. But for the most part, that's the story that you'll see in the documentary, is we're going to introduce you to one of those fighting Illini who died in World War I. And I think when they, on the Friday before that dedication game, the veterans were honored. The president of the university, David Kinley, spoke almost like Abraham Lincoln did in consecrating Gettysburg, saying these are hallowed grounds and the spirit of these Illini will always be here. And I think many people would say even today that spirit still resides at the stadium, even above and beyond football games.
Yeah. Well, tell us about some of the people you interviewed and what they had to say about what this place means to them, Memorial Stadium.
Boy, you find it's funny, you know, for a building that you go to only in the fall for football games, it has a lot of feeling, especially for people, I think, that have orange and blue blood. Dick Butkus, who we all remember as being a Bears great, was also an Illini great in the 60s. One of the stories he recalls is, for those of us who have ever walked up the ramps to get to the upper deck, gotten up there and out of breath, Dick told us he used to run the ramps to get physically fit for the games. And, of course, that sounds like Dick Butkus. Red Grange told us, he didn't tell us in an interview that we were able to obtain, Red talked about how he nearly didn't go out for football. Had it not been for his fraternity brothers threatening to paddle him, he wouldn't have gone back and tried out for football. He did, and of course, again, football was changed. The story, Celeste, of a man who was born at the stadium. in 1925. A baby was born there. But that in and of itself, we think it's probably the only birth to ever occur in a football stadium.
Yeah, and there was a football player who not only played football on the field, but also worked at the stadium.
Right. J.C. Caroline in the early 50s was a star running back for the Illini, led the nation in rushing in 52 or 53, I forget at the moment. And not only did he star on the field, but he was the night watchman for the stadium. And those are things that even surprised us. We interviewed a broadcaster from Decatur who used to do play-by-play of Illini games from the 50s through the 80s. And he surprised us by going, you're not going to believe this, but when I was 5 years old, my dad took me to that 1924 game. And you don't expect that in the middle of an interview.
Yeah. Now, you're a fan and you're an alum. Do you remember your first trip into Memorial Stadium? What were your first impressions?
Yeah, I grew up in Peoria. I came down here as a high school student. My parents brought me down. We went to a game probably in 1970. 69, something of that nature, and just going, this is amazing. I know what I want to do for college, not play football. But I know where I want to go to school because I want to be part of this environment. Even though the football team at that time was not as strong as I guess it has been in other years, there is something about college football and the pageantry and the way you feel at a game that is unmatched by, I think, any other athletic contest that you might go to. But by the way, you know, you have to remember that building has so much more than athletics. Graduations, commencements used to be held there. Farm Aid was held there.
Right. And the marching band contest every fall.
Yeah, you've been playing a marching Illini music. There was a high school marching contest held there every year. The band is such a huge part of that stadium. At one point, there was a track around the stadium, and NCAA track meets were sometimes held there. It's just an amazing place.
Yeah. Well, we'll be tuning in
Tuesday at 7 o'clock next week.
Very good. At WILL TV 12, Memorial Stadium, true Illini spirit. John Paul is the producer with Denise LaGrassa of this new documentary that will premiere next Tuesday night, September 9th at 7 on WILL TV.
And you can catch the repeat of Memorial Stadium, True Illini Spirit, coming up at 7:30 tonight on WILL-TV.
Earth and Sky.
Hyenas are known for their unusual giggles. But what does it mean when a hyena groans? That's what Frederik Thunesen is trying to find out. Thunesen studies animal communication, or biocommunication, at the University of California at Berkeley. He said because spotted hyenas are very social animals,